World 3.0, Global Prosperity and How to Achieve It. Author, Pankaj Ghimawat. Integration of Economies. Since the financial crisis of 2008, many of us had to re-examine our beliefs about markets and globalization. In World 3.0, both regulation and cross-border integration coexist and complete another. The global financial crisis has already inspired over 1,000 books, not to mention a myriad of articles, blogs, and other commentary. Few focus on what is to be done, and many of these either carry on with pre-crisis discussions of particular trends, are tactical, or are preoccupied by the short run. Colliding worldviews. The challenges we face are real. Finance is in tumult. And while worries of a banking crisis may have ebbed, fears of a crisis in public finances are running high. Global order seems more uncertain. Prosperity and power are shifting to new places and people. Old political doctrines and divisions no longer seem viable. Technology and media are changing before our eyes. So apparently is the natural environment itself. The problem is not just with our current situation, but with our responses to it. The trouble with all these remedies is that they hark back to the past, and to past ways of viewing the world. We risk reverting to unhelpful and even dangerous views that, in the worst case scenario, could lead to a catastrophic closing off of borders and global impoverishment rather than prosperity. Today's challenges call for a new way of looking at the world. Exploring World 3.0, which has clear implications for governments, businesses, and individuals. It requires governments to treat market integration and market regulation as two different dimensions of choice that have to be coordinated. Not a dichotomous, either-or choice. But before describing World 3.0 in detail, we should first consider how we got to where we are today, reviewing worlds 0.0, 1.0, 2.0. World 0.0, state of nature. Our general understanding is that modern humans came on the scene some 200,000 years ago and lived in nomadic hunter-gatherer bands or tribes until the Neolithic Revolution, 5,000 to 11,000 years ago. During this time, humanity gradually adopted fixed settlements, basic agriculture, and more complex social arrangements. It is hard to imagine the thoughts of people so long ago, and it's especially hard to ascribe a worldview to them, since they knew little beyond their immediate surroundings. But in hindsight, we can say that our ancestors did bequeath us a certain mindset, one rooted in the long human experience of banding together in small groups to survive hostile conditions. People lived at subsistence levels back then, and would continue to do so for millennia. As a result, economic inequality was minimal. But so, too, was the growth. Food was an obvious focus. The major occupational categories were foraging, hunting, and rudimentary farming. Security was critical as well. Among the hunter-gatherers of that era, the chances that one male will be killed by another are estimated to have ranged from 15 to 60%. And when a murder or theft occurred, our ancestors didn't call the police and await prosecution in a court of law. Those institutions didn't exist. They took matters into their own hands, with the help of whomever they could trust. World 1.0. Fast forward several thousand years. You will find that humanity did eventually emerge from the cycle of violence and economic stagnation of the wild world. World population increased more than 100-fold, and gross world product more than 1,000-fold in real terms. But by far the biggest change took place in the realm of a social organization. The world consolidated into fewer than 200 independent political entities, implying a several hundred thousand-fold increase in their average size, measured in terms of number of people. World 0.0's bands of several dozen people, and in its larger tribes and chiefdoms, were largely succeeded by nation-states with millions of inhabitants. Sovereignty over defined territories, and extensive state apparatus, including armies, police forces, and bureaucrats. In World 1.0, impersonal exchange and other forms of interdependence with strangers became more common. And in human terms, World 1.0 displaced some of the tribal loyalties of World 0.0, substituting broader loyalties to nation-states, past, present, or prospective. Citizenship in a particular country became, and to a large extent still is, fundamental to most people's identity. Our hearts swell with pride when we hear our nation's anthem, played in an Olympic medal ceremony. Even if we disagree with our government's foreign policies, we almost uniformly support our home country's troops in wars. Such nationalism is the handiwork of World 1.0. World 2.0. Imperialistic consolidation continued to power significant increases in cross-border integration through the 19th century. But between the two world wars, this process was partially reversed. It was not until after World War II that globalization and the kinds of challenges it posed to the Westphalian model of nation-states became part of the broader discussion. Some believed in the irresistible forces of globalization, while others could not imagine government doing anything useful beyond regulating the money supply and protecting private property. But both converged on deregulated, integrated markets as successes to World 1.0. The way forward, World 3.0. The global financial crisis prompted us to take a closer look at this representation of our policy choices as a tug of war between World 1.0 and World 2.0. The food crisis that preceded the financial crisis proved particularly illuminating. Between early 2007 and mid-2008, international rice prices tripled due to panic buying, triggering riots in more than a dozen importing countries and even toppling governments. At the same time, since only 5% of the world rice production is traded internationally, deepening international rice markets would reduce the volatility that they have to deal with, as would the abandonment of export subsidiaries and tariffs. Rice provides a clear example of markets prone to failure that could nonetheless benefit from increased cross-border integration. It helps us realize that the tension between World 1.0 and World 2.0 embodies not one fundamental trade-off, but disagreements over two types of choices. Choices concerning the regulation of markets and choices concerning cross-border integration. World 3.0's first attraction is that it is more realistic. It not only recognizes actual levels of cross-border integration, it also accounts for how geographic and other forms of difference distance typically affects cross-border flows. World 3.0's empirically grounded, explicitly spatial structure, in which both borders and distance are important, is one of the key features that distinguish it from both World 1.0, in which only borders matter, and World 2.0, in which neither do. World 3.0 is also more realistic about human nature. Transforming the world would be easy if we could motivate humans to curb their desires significantly. World 3.0 strives for more realism about what drives us, but without sacrificing morality. It recognizes that self-interest is important, but also provides a basis rooted in distance, for bringing awareness of, sympathy for, and altruism towards others in the picture, in order to consider how we might make some progress along those dimensions. By contrast, World 0.0 and 1.0 embody an us-versus-them approach that ignores foreign welfare entirely, and World 2.0, where there is no us or them, weights foreign welfare the same as domestic welfare, which is frankly otherworldly. More important attraction of World 3.0 is that it highlights the gains from opening up further. World 2.0 presumes that complete openness had been achieved, or soon will be, so that while preventing losses due to backsliding is important, generating gains through further opening is not. And World 1.0 turns its back on gains through openness. A final attraction of World 3.0 is that it provides a relatively specific grounded framework for action, and it provides from different premises to prescriptions that differ substantially from the worldviews that preceded it. Adding value by opening up. World is not as globalized as many people think, and levels of cross-border integration are sensitive to the cultural, administrative, geographic, and economic differences between countries. Thinking about gains from more openness only makes sense within the context of World 3.0. Believers in World 1.0 tend to either ignore cross-border interactions or focus on restricting, reversing them. And those still true to World 2.0 presumably see integration as having proceeded so far that relatively little is to be gained through more openness. World 3.0 is an essential construct because focusing on just World 1.0 and 2.0 conflates questions of integration and regulation into a tug of war along a single dimension. Before crisis, we had tended to associate globalization with deregulation and high barriers at national borders with regulation within them. What does World 3.0 offer to eliminate fears? What can be offered here are six propositions about the nexus between market failures and fears with market integration. Propositions about how to manage World 3.0. 1. Market failures and fears need to be incorporated into analysis of integration. 2. Choices concerning integration and regulation almost always mix opportunities to grow the economic pie with potential shifts in how it gets shared. 3. In many other cases, integration has a negligible effect on market failures and therefore should not be restricted. 4. When integration does threaten to aggravate market failures, mix and match policies try to preserve some of the benefits of opening up while curbing adverse effects. The mix and match possibilities afforded by targeting policies to specific flows can also be augmented by tailoring policies to particular foreign countries, applying them for limited time periods, imposing caps on various flows, and so on. 5. Distance sensitivity is inversely related to the optimal scope of integrative and regulatory initiative. Lower levels of distance sensitivity tend to imply larger, more far-flung natural markets, expanding the optimal scope of efforts to boost cross-border integration. Compare markets for airplanes with markets for haircuts, for instance. Domestic regulation can usually address domestic problems more effectively than restrictions on cross-border flows. Thus, with intermediate levels of distance sensitivity that imply the scope of the market failure is regional, regional cooperation is appropriate. 6. Large integration opportunities often exist within as well as across national borders, even when it looks messy. World 3.0 is a complex place. But it is that diverse and messy reality that also gives rise to the enormous opportunities associated with crossing borders. You should, at this point, have a broad view of these possibilities and a bit less irrational fear about them. Now, it is time to continue elaborating the path towards World 3.0 from the perspectives of countries, companies, and ordinary people, perspectives that will allow further customization of the broad recommendations.